talking about Iran today, many cannot discern what's really happening in Iran and what the short term will bring. Is the regime on the edge? And will President Trump intervene, as he has suggested? What will be the impact of this? And will we see more violent deaths? Why is Donald Trump embarking on what it seems to be a series of interventions on several problem countries? Is he going for regime change, or are we witnessing a unique strategy of getting deals done? How reckless or wise is this strategy? Whether these are monumental distractions from domestic political and financial problems, or if they will elicit a global crisis. We'll discuss that too. Iran is widely regarded as a highly complex country, stemming from its hybrid political system, diverse society, history and culture, and its challenging geopolitical position and relationship with surrounding countries and ongoing tensions with the US and Israel. Iran's economy has been severely hampered by extensive international sanctions, corruption, high inflation and unemployment, creating a difficult environment for all of its citizens. Is the rule of the mullahs who have governed Iran for over 47 years since the 1979 Islamic Revolution over? Do the Iranian people want regime change overseen by America and Israel? The propaganda flooding social media and mainstream media platforms may suggest this. Or are the protest and current volatile environment the result of international manipulation that may again prove ineffective? Let's talk to our panel today, who may offer different perspectives, and they are all very, very up to date with what's happening. Our panel is Professor David Miller from the Istanbul Zaim University, Robert Barwick, Australian Citizens Party, and Tony Gosling, freelance investigative journalist. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, Robert, can you just tell me your thoughts on what is happening at the moment in Iran? And not forgetting that we've had so many reports from legacy media and from social media, independent media, and all of them. And each one has sort of coming up with a slightly different slant on what is happening. So to get the actual information, because they say that they have no internet, the information is very sparse. So from what you know, tell us what your thoughts are on what is happening at the moment with Iran.
Well, I can't get past Mike Pompeo's tweet. And to me, that captures the whole story. So Mike Pompeo tweeted a few days ago that Mossad agents were alongside the protesters in Iran. Now, what I'm trying to figure out though is, was he just, you know, because he's such so fanatically pro-Israel, was he just gloating about that, or was he provoking the Iranian administration by making such a boast? Because Donald Trump had said that if Iran starts killing people, then he would intervene. And what we seem to have witnessed since then is a no-holds-barred effort to prove to Trump that Iran is killing protesters. You've got the usual kinds of suspects, in the Australian media down here at the moment, Mike, they're calling them Iranian rights groups. You know, these blandly worded organizations. I think the main one they're quoting is this one that operates out of Virginia in America, making all these claims about the supposed death toll. Yeah. But whatever the truth of that is, and I'm pretty sure that the 20,000 figure that it reached today is probably completely unrealistic and outside the realm of possibility. But whatever the truth of that is, nevertheless, the former U.S. Secretary of State and Director of the CIA has made a name for himself in the last week or so, boasting that Mossad agents are there, which, what would any government do? Seriously, what would any government do if they're confronted with violent protests and the people who are backing the protest are bragging that there's foreign intelligence agents among them helping to organise the protest? You're going to provoke a reaction. Mm. So that's what I'm paying most attention to at the moment. Aside from, I have to say, I didn't realise this would be able to do this today. Our two other guests, I'm familiar with both of them in different ways. I've been receiving Tony Gosling's emails for a million years, but in the last few weeks, I just find myself retweeting David Miller a lot. So it's funny that it's worked out that we're all on the same panel together.
It's one of your bucket list wishes. I'm just saying that because I'm very grateful that David joins us. David, what's your impressions at the moment? What's your summary of the whole situation?
Well, you're right to point to Pompeo's message, but it's not just Pompeo bragging. The Mossad have been saying openly on Israeli media that they're there, and that what they're saying is that when the regime, as they call it, falls, they will do exactly the same to Iran as they did to Syria, which is to take out all of their military defensive capability. So that's what the Mossad are planning. They've got people on the ground in Iran, as we have seen, from various different groups. They've also recruited a whole host of Afghan refugees who are the cheapest ones to recruit inside Iran, so it's said. So that this is a Mossad-inspired, directed, orchestrated, in quotes, uprising, which, of course, is where all sorts of propaganda is being circulated. There is 1.5 million people on the streets. It's not protests, it's revolution. Well, we know now that that is a fantasy. At best, they had 12,000 people on the streets a few days ago. That was the high point. And the protests have more or less entirely finished now. When I say the protests are finished, I mean the anti-government protests orchestrated by the Mossad. The protests in Iran haven't finished because, of course, we've seen several 1 million man and woman marches in Tehran and indeed in Isfahan, in Mashhad and in other places inside Iran, all of which are there supporting the government and opposing US and Israeli interventions in their country. So that's the situation we see. Of course, the propaganda about the 20,000 deaths. Well, at maximum, if you have 12,000 people in one day out demonstrating, it's difficult to imagine how 20,000 deaths could have come from that. And of course, although we've seen pictures of body bags, the reality is that two-thirds, roughly, of those bodies of dead people have been caused by the Mossad assets, including, of course, 3-year-old girl, an 8-year-old girl, nurses and teachers, and other civilians who have been killed by these anti-government protesters. And then, of course, let's remember, and imagine this happened in the UK or in Australia. Significant numbers of local police and volunteer people's defence forces have been killed. There have been attacks on mosques. 35 mosques have been burnt to the ground. They've been attacking ancient libraries. These are not the activities of civil rights protesters. These are the activities of foreign intervention attempting to destroy the country. There is no way in which actual Iranians would be burning mosques. It is simply impossible that would be the case. So what we see is an orchestrated attempt to destroy the country. And it's an attempt which has now, it seems, come to an end. But of course, it's in the context which you mentioned at the beginning about Donald Trump. And I would say a few words about that before I stopped now. And of course, Donald Trump is doing a whole variety of things. And it turns out, when you look at these things, that they have a connection, all of them, to the Zionist entity, to Israel. We saw that in Venezuela with the Zionist oligarch Paul Singer making billions of dollars from the oil contracts which he was given shortly before they kidnapped Maduro. We see that in Greenland, where there are Zionist oligarchs attempting to pressure the Greenland government, the Greenlandic government, by investing in Greenland. And we see that also, of course, in Iran, where it's perfectly plain, as everybody knows, that the Zionists have it as their top priority to remove the government of Iran, because the government of Iran, let's be clear and remember, is the main threat that there is to the genocide in Gaza. It's the main country which is willing and able and has been willing and able for 47 years to take on the Zionists, not just diplomatically, but actually militarily. And that's the top priority for Israel, is to destroy Iran. And when Trump talked about acting against Iran, he's simply doing the bidding of Netanyahu and the genocide heirs in Tel Aviv.
Tony Gosling, a freelance investigative journalist who's now awake, fourth cup of coffee, very early from New York. He doesn't get up until the crack of midday, something like that. Tony, can you just tell me quickly your thoughts on what you've just heard, and also your thoughts on the reporting from legacy media, and also on social media and also independent media. Seems to be a lot of, as we would say in Australia, a lot of cow manure as part of that reporting. Would you agree? And what's your impressions?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to find more on the present situation to say about this than David has just done. He's done a pretty good roundup there. Mm. But you have to understand also that Netanyahu has been doing this thing from Israel directly over the last couple of years since the genocide began in Gaza, making these direct appeals to the population of Iran, which is something, there's something quite bizarre about this, where he's saying, you know, everything will get better for you in Iran if you just topple your own country. Now, I don't think this is really aimed at the population in Iran at all. It's aimed at an English-speaking European and US audience. And he said about these present protests, he says, I want you to imagine how your life could be different if Iran was free. So this is Netanyahu speaking. Now, that's actually, I think, again, aimed at a Western audience, an English-speaking Western audience. So this is aimed at the so-called riot, you know. Well, they don't even call them rioters. These are protesters. We're not hearing about riots, which is what's been going on over there. So the use of language is specific, isn't it? That's one aspect of this, where we're seeing actually something which is largely not to do with Iran. It's to do with preparing a Western population for a specific narrative, which is all about how terrible things are for the poor Iranians and how they're uprising. And this is one of the characteristics of this modern television age, where most of us are just going about our lives, and the TV people are trusted to show us what's going on in other parts of the world. Trump has also talking about all this, saying about Venezuela specifically, but this applies to all these interventions the US are up to around the world. He's saying, my own morality, my own mind is the only thing that can stop me. That's what his statement last Friday, I think it was, about Venezuela. And when he was New York Times were asking him about what he was up to by kidnapping a foreign leader. Actually, I wouldn't even use that word kidnap about Maduro. He's taken Maduro hostage in order to close deals with the remains of the Venezuelan government, with the blockade that he's doing on their trade. So he's basically saying that you've got to do as we say. And he also says, I don't need international law, when he's talking to the New York Times. International law really is all about depends on your definition of what international law is. So he's saying he is the guy to define international law now. This is a New York property speculator who's made his money through dodgy deals on big buildings and plots of land in one of the most shark-infested waters in the world. So this, I'm afraid, he's no JFK, he's no Kennedy. You know, if it comes to nuclear confrontation around the world, this is the guy who thinks that he can close a deal by imposing his own version of morality, his own version of international law on the rest of the world. So we're in a pretty dangerous place, I think, with this guy in charge. So we're right now He's also saying, keep protesting, help is on the way to these people who have now pretty much finished their protest. Many of them have been arrested, apprehended, or melted back into the population. And it threatening, obviously, to intervene in Iran. Now, this is an absolutely horrific state of affairs for the world. So we're on the edge, really, aren't we? We're on the edge of a potential enormous war with nuclear-armed Israel, too, being involved in this potentially. And obviously the temptation on Iran is for them to do what the North Koreans and others have done, is that they may have to develop nuclear weapons in order to keep the United States and Israel at bay, who are quite clearly trying to put them in the line of many of these other countries that have had these Orange Revolution style regime change, like Tunisia, the regime change in Libya, Syria, and of course that was around the Arab Spring 2011, Egypt, that where there was a overthrowing the government due to street protests, but returning back to a kind of US military style rule in Egypt, and Ukraine in 2014, the Maidan Square Orange Revolution style takeover by the United States and the European Union. Mostly the United States. So that's what they're trying to do in Iran. And the Anglo-Zionist Empire is putting us on a military knife edge here with a potential Third World War, as well as, of course, leaving us in the lurch with massive debt and a economic nightmare. So really, much of this, I think, is targeted at Western populations rather than just the people of Iran. And that's the treachery of the Western press, all lined up with this same sort of narrative, really to bamboozle their own people and trick them, is absolutely appalling. So thank you very much for doing broadcasts like this to try and puncture that bubble a bit.
We often puncture bubbles, but hasn't gotten us very far. Let me tell you that. I just want to ask David, if you don't mind, the greatest threat to, there's two questions here. The greatest threat to peace in Iran, the mullahs, or is it the US, or is it Israel? And part two of this, do the people of Iran want a regime change in the first place?
Well, I think the term the mullahs is problematic. I mean, look, as you said at the beginning, Iran is a complex society. I've been there a couple of times. I was last there last May. I have contacts inside Iran who I have been communicating with, even despite this blackout. And it's a complex society in a number of ways. It's a large society. It has a history, but it's complex in particular in relation to its current politics. I mean, we have, when people talk about the mullahs or the ayatollahs, it's a society in which Islam plays a significant role. It's called the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it was Islam as the religion which formed the basis for the political ideas for those who took over the society and ejected the Western-backed puppet, the Shah. Now, currently, of course, when people talk about return to democracy, I saw Priti Patel on your show, on your news item at the top there, talking about the return of democracy to Iran. Well, Iran is a democracy. As everybody knows, when President Raisi was, what looks like now, assassinated just the other year, they elected a new president, President Pezeshkian. Now, Pezeshkian is not, quote, a mullah. He's not an imam. He's not a Muslim cleric. He is, in fact, a reformist. And so, of course, there is, inside Iran, a conflict between those who style themselves reformists, the liberals, the neoliberals, who want to bring in reforms and who want to make a deal with America. In fact, many of the people who are associated with that tendency have been trying to communicate with Trump and say we want to have some kind of agreement. And they are opposed, of course, by the principalists, the ones who believe in the revolution, who believe that there is no possible deal that can be done with America or indeed with the Zionists, and that actually there's an existential threat to the Republic, which can only be resolved with the removal of the Zionist colony in the Levant and the final defeat of Zionism in West Asia. So, and those principles, of course, represented most obviously by the leader, the supreme leader, who doesn't have a formal political position, but is the theological if you like, spiritual leader of the country. That's Imam Khamenei. Now, that's a conflict internal in Iran, and it's a conflict which is ongoing. But when you say, do the people in Iran want regime change? Well, I mentioned before, at best, 12,000 people on the streets in one day, many of whom paid by the Mossad or direct Mossad agents, and then followed by million-man marches in several cities in support of the government, in which the reformists, including President Pezeshkian, took part. So that's really quite different from talking about regime change. Of course, not even Pezeshkian believes openly, at least, in regime change, the vast bulk of the population of Iran are loyal to the Islamic Republic and have been made more loyal by the attacks on it by the Zionists in the last couple of years, as we saw the unprovoked attack by the Zionists on the Iranian consulate in Damascus during the process there, which led, of course, to the 12-day war, in which eventually, after 12 days, the Zionists sued for peace, and the Americans pressured the Iranian government to stop firing missiles because the missiles were being so effective. So we have a situation where Iran is under existential threat by the Zionists. Probably there will be further attacks, maybe involving the Americans very shortly. But it's not clear from outside observers that these will be successful for Israel and for America, because of course, if a war drags on, it's not impossible that the Iranians would win that war. And let's remember that the kind of imperial overreach we've seen in previous American interventions in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, and indeed previously in Iran. I mean, when I was in Iran last year, I went to the American embassy, or I should say the former American embassy, where there is now a museum, which is called, I believe, the Den of Spying Museum, right? And they've put on display everything that was in the museum when the students took it over in 1980, just after the revolution, including they waited for 2.5 hours to get into the embassy because the staff had locked the doors. They went over the fences and they were locked outside. In the 2.5 hours, the CIA station inside the embassy were furiously shredding documents. And they got in after 2.5 hours. And the students, they had nothing else to do apart from keep 60 Americans hostage. They reconstructed from the shredded documents all of the original documents and then published them in a 28-volume series, which is still legal for American citizens to own to this day. So that was an imperial overreach. And of course, the Americans lost then. And so it's not very clear that either the Americans, given the advanced nature of drone warfare and missile warfare now, or the Zionists can beat Iran, because it's a significant and serious impediment to the continuation of genocide in the land. So I don't think that we're going to see regime change there. The people don't want regime change. What we're seeing is the attempt to defend the gains, as the Zionists would see it, of the genocide. And of course, they are the hampering of Hezbollah in Lebanon, the destruction of the Assad government in Syria, and the bringing in of an ISIS in suits government, which now has a formal, quote, fusion agreement with Israel, so it effectively is a Zionist vassal. The standing down of the Iraqi resistance. They haven't defeated Yemen yet, and they haven't defeated Iran yet, but they think that they are winning. And it's only Iran, really, with the help of Yemen, that can defeat them.
Can I just ask one more thing, David, before I pop over to Robert? This, you know, the information that we are receiving, or the West is receiving, the rest of the world is receiving, seems out of the rule book, the 101, how to do good information operations. And this would seem to be an information operation at its probably worst or best, whichever way you look at it. This would have been in the planning for quite some time, because the information that's getting out, and if you go back the war on terror with Iraq, similar thing with Bell Pottinger then. Do you have any idea who the corporation is at the moment doing the information operation? Is it the same mob that did the war with Russia and Ukraine? Because we do have some information on that from way back. I'm not too sure about how this is going. But it almost seems, you know, the handbook, page 1, do that, page 2, do that, and so forth. Would you agree or not agree?
Yeah, look, I mean, when you say Bell Pottinger, let's remember that Bell Pottinger came into Iraq after the aftershock and all, or after the removal of Hussein, and they had a long term process where they eventually lost, and Bell Pottinger were brought in to do that. And of course, in the case of, for example, of Syria, the lead agency in that case was, of course, MI6, the British Foreign Intelligence Agency, which has a whole host of PR firms on roster who were involved in supporting what they called the moderate armed opposition, which turned out to be Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and who they then put in power. But let's remember that MI6 apparently has an office in Jelani's presidential palace, and that's why, of course, the agreement with Israel is called a fusion agreement, because that's a term which comes from British intelligence doctrine. So, look, of course, there are all sorts of agencies involved. In the specific case of Iran presently, the numbers that you're seeing, 12,000 dead, 20,000 dead, however many it is, these are numbers which are coming, as someone, I think was it Tony pointed out, no, it was Robert, you pointed out, these are numbers which are coming from organizations which are based in the US and sometimes in the UK, and which are funded by an organization called the National Endowment for Democracy. And as everybody knows who's paid any attention to this stuff, this is a CIA front. This is an organization which its own leader said was created to do overtly what the CIA had previously done covertly, and that is to fund propaganda and information operations around the world. And of course, they're big on talking about the agency of the Iranian people, and this is people who are, you know, who are funded directly as agents of the CIA in Iran. So, of course, we know that the CIA are involved, but this is an operation which is being directed by and in the interests of the Zionists preeminently. And of course, they are engaged in their own information operations. The Israeli paper Haaretz just the other day had a large expose of the millions of dollars which are going into Zionist Israeli bot armies to flood the internet with the kind of stuff that we're getting. And the sad thing about it is not just that the mainstream media, legacy media, as you referred to it, is parroting this stuff, meaning that if you pay attention to the mainstream media, you have an impossibly distorted view of what's going on in Iran. But the sad thing about it seems to me, is that large sections of the left in the UK, in Western Europe, in the US, and indeed internationally, have absorbed key elements of that. And they say, of course, we don't want regime change, but nevertheless, terrible regime in Iran. And the terrible regime in Iran is the world's predominant and preeminent anti-imperialist nation. And it bears no resemblance whatsoever to the kinds of stories which one hears about it. And in particular, of course, people say, oh, what about women's rights? Well, you know, the rights of women in Iran to be involved in professional occupations are way in excess as a proportion of women in the UK or in Australia, and the number of Iranian women in Iran currently with OnlyFans accounts is tending towards zero in a way which is not the case in Western society. So look, I think we're seeing information operations, and what I would hope is that people try and find out more about Iran. It's a very complex society. It has its own politics, and you can have all sorts of views inside Iran about what the politics are, none of which will go anywhere near the idea that the Zionists should be taking it over.
Robert, I just want to know, I mean, if what's your thoughts, if there is a stoush and we do something like, you know, the war on terror, I really hope not. But I'm just thinking if there is that war and we have a stoush with, to free Iran. How do you think it'll go? Do you think it'll be a very quick battle? Because don't forget, Israel and the US have really big bombs, big, beautiful bombs, as Donald would say. But there would also have to be an element of feet on the ground, such as with infantry and stuff like that. Do you see Australia, because we have Albanese, Anthony Albanese, our Rambo Prime Minister. We see that he is, he's stamping out all bad things around Australia, and he has this allegiance towards I suppose, the US to some degree, and a great deal of allegiance to China, which does cause conflict more within his mind than anybody else's. But do you see Australia and do you see other countries being the coalition of the willing to pop into Iran and get rid of those evil people?
Well, possibly, because there seems to be no limit to human insanity. I think when we're confronted with a question like would regime change in Iran work? Quite a few years ago now, well, actually 10 years ago, our organisation was very involved in commenting for Australians and exposing for Australians what was happening in Syria. And that was the year that the UK House of Commons Libya report came out, 2016. You can look it up, just called the Libya report. And if you remember how Libya went, it seemed to be pretty quick. There was a lot of gloating at the time. Dr. Brendan Sims, one of the most evil organizations I could possibly think of, the Henry Jackson Society in the UK, named after the founder of the American neocons, but a British neocon think tank. He gloated in an article at the time in late 2011. The headline of his article was something like, "See, democracy can be dropped from 10,000 feet." And that was his playing on what David Cameron had said when Cameron was initially reluctant to be trapped into going into Libya. He said, "You can't drop democracy from 10,000 feet." These fanatics at the Henry Jackson Society gloated at the outcome. See, we've done it. We've dropped democracy from 10,000 feet. But 5 years later, the UK House of Commons report said, I mean, you got to read it. Just read the introduction. Basically said this thing was just as big a screw up as Iraq. It was based on false intelligence. We didn't realize we were backing extremists, etc. We've created a failed state. That's what that UK House of Commons report said. And that was a regime change that everyone considered at the time successful. And the little I know is that of all the states in the Middle East, none can match Iran for its actual power. Now, I never claim to be an expert in these areas, but I pay a lot of attention to sources where I can. I just happen to work with somebody in our party here in Australia who works full-time in our office with me, who's an Iraqi. He fled to Australia after the Gulf War in 1991. But before that, he fought in the Iran-Iraq War. And when my friend talks about this subject, he would warn anybody, Mike, there's no way any war with Iran by any entity is going to be a cakewalk. Because what he saw the Iranians were capable of, just their sheer tenacity and stubbornness as fighters in that war. He saw it. He witnessed it. He compares them. I don't know if this is positive or not, but he basically compares them to the tenacity of the Japanese in World War II, which, of course, you know, the idea of having to invade the Japanese mainland became the excuse for dropping the bomb. But in other words, he's only saying that to make the point that these are fighters that are not going to give up. Now, so I know that. I know my friend. He had that direct experience, and that's what I'm recounting here. I don't know if that gels with more sophisticated analyses or not, but whether it does or not, my personal view is that we should have learned from Iraq. That's been the big issue. That Iraq was the big blunder in my lifetime. The more I've read as I've got older, I realize that you know, post-World War II, America has just been one after another. They should have learned from Vietnam, right? They should have learned from Iraq. They should have learned from Libya. We've created an absolute mess in Syria. I deal with people here in Australia who are Alawites, whose families are being slaughtered by this regime in Syria that's now acceptable to the West, unelected regime, mind you. We gloss over all these things when it suits us. We demonize the countries who dare to stand up to us. And if we're not going to learn from our blunders, then we're probably doomed to repeat it. But this might be the one that we all regret more than any other.
Tony, what do you think? I mean, also what do you think Trump will do if he wants to replace the regime? He's going to bring peace And if you can't bring peace, we'll bomb the crap out of them just to bring peace. And if no one's alive, well, then there's peace. If you sort of follow what that means. But what do you think he'll do? And who would he... I mean, first of all, they don't want a regime change. And secondly, he'd have to put someone else in charge, which could be worse than what we have at the moment, which, according to David, isn't too bad at all. So, I mean, I'm just thinking, what happens with... what does Trump do? And I'm asking you to look inside the mind of a very complex person. So what do you think he would do?
Well, he'll do whatever Jared Kushner suggests and Netanyahu suggests, because this, I think, is something which is actually being run out of Tel Aviv and London rather than Washington, although, of course, they've got lots of cheerleaders over there. I mean, this is something that we pull apart every week. I do a weekly 3-hour podcast here that looks at all over the world at thisweek.org.uk. If people are interested in subscribing to this, the newsletter you referred to earlier that I do. But look, you know, what's he going to do? He's going to deny the rule of Iran to the Iranian people. He's going to take out the civil society and destroy democracy. This is what he does everywhere, and this is where what the Americans do wherever they go, because they don't want democracy. We don't have democracy in the West either at all, really. Very well, a little bit here and there, maybe local authorities, because our leaders are decided for us. You know, you get a choice between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, you know, with a resurgent party like we've got in the UK, like Reform. This is also a City of London loyal shareholder loyal party, much of my work over the years has been looking at the Bilderberg Group and their role in making sure after World War II, as they were chaired by an SS officer for the first 20 years up until the mid 70s, of just literally big business choosing our leaders and saying who is going to be a major opposition figure. Somebody like Tony Blair, for example, was looked at and selected by these people to be the leader after the suspicious death of John Smith back in the 1990s. And look, so we don't have democracy here, and we don't want democracy to be allowed to thrive anywhere else in the world. I think that's essentially it. They don't really care what happens, and look at Libya, so long as there's no actual ability for the local population to thrive and to have their own decisions implemented by a national government. And there's also a really important, I think, aspect that often gets missed with Iran is this spiritual battle, really, between the Zionists in Israel, who I think it's pretty, you know, you could make a very strong argument that there really is nothing Jewish about Zionism, that this is a project from the Wagnerian era, which was always designed to hijack Judaism, to hijack the Old Testament, the Torah, the Talmud, in order to create problems and of an imperialist nature in the Middle East. And, of course, it's being set against Islam, which is a morality which is actually very similar to Christianity in many ways. I mean, we keep hearing about Sharia law. Well, it's actually very similar to church law, and those various ideas of sort of liberal politics and liberal spirituality, if you want, the way that the liberal insurgency has come along over the years, has really just kicked out any idea of God, morality, and that sort of thing from. And so, in a way, what you're looking at with Iran is similar to Britain, maybe in the Victorian or anywhere up till the 1960s, where you've got this context, a democratic context of a moral Christian, in the case of the UK, nominally anyway, and Muslim in terms of Islam. So you've got a moral framework of the system by which people elect their governments. But that, of course, is not the case at all in the West. So I just see this as a sort of modern version of Hitler's persecution of the Jews. the non-Zionist, generally Jews, who were persecuted and not just obviously not persecuted, massacred in their hundreds of thousands and millions by Adolf Hitler, is what's happening now to the Muslims. I think exactly. You've got the Zionist entity, as some call it, or the State of Israel, actually doing exactly the same to the Muslim neighborhood of the Middle East as Adolf Hitler and his chums did to the European Jewry back in the 1930s and 1940s. So I think that's a really important thing to understand, that this is being set up, I think, deliberately polarized in the Middle East for a conflict in the future. And quite what the purpose of all this is, it seems to me to be accelerationist, and also it's very much like Naomi Klein's shock doctrine on about the biggest possible scale you can imagine, to have a massive conflict that you hope that you will be able to then control the outcome, very much like people like Elon Musk are trying to stir up British society to violence. The idea is move fast and break things, and then as people are running around like headless chickens, not knowing what they're doing, whether it's on the streets of London or in the Middle East, to then impose your new system upon them. And I think these people have got so much money and time that they are prepared to take these stakes right up to the very end, and they don't care how many people die and how many casualties there are in their conflicts. So I think that to understand this spiritual aspect to it, I think is really important. It's almost like another dimension the mainstream media never touch.
David, I'm just looking. I've just started to watch Tehran, and I've actually turned it off now that I understand a little more, not a whole lot, a little more about Iran itself. And even Homeland, I used to watch. And I think, what garbage, and I got sucked in beautifully. And I did got sucked in, but I did like the acting. Now, with any good conflict, you've got to have some good actors. And at the moment, we've got the protesters. The protesters are out there. They're fighting for their freedom. Can you tell us more about the protesters and your thoughts on who's funding them?
Well, we know quite a lot about that. I mean, let's recall the Women Life Freedom demonstrations of some 3 or 4 years ago, which were much, much bigger set of demonstrations actually involving Iranians than the current ones, though, of course, they were directed by the CIA and, of course, by the Mossad. But there are many different anti-government Iranian groups outside Iran in the diaspora, and people will have seen some of their spokespeople over the years. And now many of these are directly funded either by Israel or indeed by the National Endowment for Democracy or by similar foundations. There's a whole range of different foundations, and especially in the US, but also in the UK, which fund some of these groups, which are effectively used by the CIA as pass-through. So, I mean, this is known historically that, for example, the Rockefeller Foundation, or there's an organization in the UK called the Rousing Trust, which funds a lot of these organizations and also funds a range of Zionist groups. And it kind of looks like that what's currently happening with that is the CIA passes the money through so that it doesn't look like it's coming direct from the CIA. I imagine that's what will be happening. And the CIA, of course, has this strategy called the small media strategy, whereby it funds small citizen media, which look like they're independent, but which are, of course, reflecting the foreign policy interests of the US, which, of course, almost perfectly align with those of the Zionists, because effectively the Zionists run the US. And Tony made allusions to that before about Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. But, of course, the Zionist billionaires also are a key element of this, and they fund a lot of the foundations which fund a lot of this activity. But also, let's remember that one of the reasons why it's the case that the Zionists are able to have such an influence in the US, as they do in many other countries, including in Australia, is that they have people positioned, especially in the US, people positioned throughout the apparatus in the CIA in the Pentagon less than in the CIA, in the State Department, even in the Treasury Department. The people who direct the sanctions against Iran in America, in the Treasury Department, are paid up lifelong Zionists. And so what you have is people say, how could a small country like Israel possibly dictate what happens in America, which is a massive army and empire? Well, the reason is because they have systematically been able to infiltrate the apparatus of government. And most obviously, that was the case. It was the case to some extent before, but most obviously it was the case with the neoconservatives, who are almost to a part, well, no. I shouldn't say the word almost, who are to a person genocidal Zionists. And they have been able to put themselves in place to make sure that the US invaded Iraq for Israel. Let's remember, the Israelis were kept out of that. But the war for Iraq was a war effectively for Israel, not for oil, as some people continue to say. It was directed effectively by the Zionists. And that's the position we're in, that the Zionists effectively run the foreign policy of the US. I saw the same thing in the recent events in Australia. I've just done a show, our show Palestine Declassified this weekend will be about Australia and about the epidemic of hoax anti-Semitic attacks, which the police, of course, said were done by a crime network. And then the Mossad came in and told the ASIO that this was the Iranians. The Iranians had been doing fake anti-Semitic attacks because that's the kind of things that the Iranians do. Manifestly preposterous, but a manifestly preposterous statement, which was backed up by the head of the ASIO. And the ASIO even said, oh, yes, the Mossad gave us some information, but we already knew that it was the Iranians. Now, what's going on here is this subordination of the Australian Domestic Intelligence Service by the Mossad, which is a truly extraordinary state of affairs. Either the ASIO knows that it's not the Iranians who did these fake attacks, or they don't know, in which case that's perhaps even worse, that they have been penetrated so badly. And of course, the apparatus of government, of course, is fully bought into that. Albanese, for example, and others. So, but that's the case, I think, with all Western nations, that there's a penetration by the Mossad and Israeli intelligence, which we haven't come to terms with. We haven't really fully appreciated what's happened there and the way in which that will start to influence, and it already is influencing our world. Now, so when you go back to Iran, of course, there is no appetite inside Iran for regime change. There is no appetite for all of their military capabilities and defense capabilities to be bombed into nothingness by the Israeli Air Force. And indeed, there is an appetite, as there has been from the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution. The first person, one of the first people to foreign officials to visit Iran after the revolution in 1979 was who? It was Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO, and ever since then, the Iranians have supported Palestinian liberation directly, politically and directly, militarily, as everybody knows. The reason that Hamas had the rockets was because they were directed to go there by Qasem Soleimani of the IRGC Quds Force, who, of course, was assassinated by Donald Trump in 2020, some 6 years ago now. So there is no appetite in Iran for a regime change, and there is an appetite to see the liberation of Palestine. And it's only by supporting the Islamic Republic of Iran and its axis of resistance that we will see the end of the genocide in Gaza.
The world is looking remarkably unsteady at the moment. And I go back to when Trump got in. I thought it's going to be a very boring time. How wrong I was. But it's getting even more exciting. If you look at Trump, Robbie, with... He with Venezuela, and then he's going to have probably a stoush with the Netherlands. He's going to have a stoush actually with all of Europe, which will have the British fighting the Americans just all over again. And then he has a stoush with Cuba, and it's a stoush with Mexico and anybody else. And he sort of has gone this. He must have had some New Year's Eve party of some note, and his New Year's resolution. I would love to know what that was. But he is creating all sorts of unrest around the world. What I haven't seen a whole lot of late, and the shooting, the criminal activity of shooting 15 people at a religious celebration, and that's what it was, which has caused all sorts of horrors for Australia. And after next week, we're going to be in all sorts of trouble because you can get charged retrospectively on things for that were once legal. I haven't seen, though, it's interesting, the outrage for these people, and I'm going to say imaginary, the 20,000, you know, 30,000 deaths in, and sure, people have been killed, but it would seem that many of those who are outraged at this perception of people being killed in Iran, where were they when people were being killed in, the Palestinians have been killed in Gaza? I mean, if I recall correctly, it's about 200,000 children, women, and other innocent people that were killed, including many journalists, if they were to report the truth. Yet they're there waving their flags for those that have been killed or supposedly killed in Iran. And this could go to everybody. Is this part of an information operation that sort of swings everybody away from the atrocities that happen by the Israel government towards innocent people in Gaza? It deflects, and if you look at what happened in Australia, it's deflecting them. You can't even protest now because you're regarded as an anti-Semitic or a possible murderer. And David is right. ASIO did say, and the federal police did say, it was not a religious crime. They were not going out shooting because they were Jewish people, that Islam was going to shoot them all. It was nothing of the sort. So I'm just wondering, where are the people that were that ignored those killed in Gaza? Where are they? Why are they supporting this mass killing of innocent people, protesters in Iran? Or is it part of the information operation to distort the truth and create a narrative that really isn't real at all?
Is that to either, any of us or to me?
Yeah, to everybody. So, David, pop in there. Robert, you can do it, and Tony, because I see this as theatre, bad theatre.
It is theatre. I mean, look, the Zionists want to make sure that you see them as the victims. I saw Pompeo, I think it was, just yesterday, saying, when the history of the genocide is, well, he didn't call it a genocide, when the history of Gaza is written, it would be important that we see the real victims as Israel and not the Palestinians. Now, that's a very early attempt to completely invert what happened in Gaza, which was, of course, as everybody knows, and as history will record, a genocide. So the Zionists want to make sure that they are seen as the victims, that Israel is seen as the victims, that Jews worldwide are seen as the victims, are seen as the only worthy victims. And, of course, take the example of Australia. The response to Bondi is to say that the community security group, which is the Zionist organization which provides security and weaponizes anti-Semitism, that they should have more access to weapons, that there should be Jewish militias on the streets in Australia to defend the specific interests of Jews. Now, people are saying, well, what about Muslim or Hindu or Sikh or white people's militias? Well, of course, none of that's going to happen because it's only the Jews who are regarded as being worthy victims in this, in that kind of sense. And that's why we care more about victims, alleged victims of the alleged regime in Iran, than we do care about dead Palestinians in Gaza, because there's this hierarchy in the way in which we see these things, which is not as simple as saying it's an information operation. Of course, there are information operation components to it, but there's a hierarchy in the way we see the victims, and the most worthy victims, to use the term worthy and unworthy victims, which pioneered by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky in their valuable work on this, the most worthy victims are Jews. Not even white people, but Jews. And that's the problem, is that we have this hierarchy, which of course has its own history and comes out of the Holocaust, and we understand all of that. But we don't see other victims of genocides in anything like the same way as we do the Jews. If we did, then we would have all sorts of more important ways of understanding, for example, Aboriginals in Australia or the genocides in Africa, etc. So it's a more complicated than an information operation, but it's certainly the case that the Mossad of the Zionists make sure to try and show that the only people who are genuine victims of these things are the Jews and nobody else, and therefore they deserve special protection.
But they don't, do they? They don't. They don't deserve special protection particularly at all. And I mean, you know, just look at what's been happening in the opening weeks of 2026. This is what I would call classic accelerationism. The idea is events are changing and unfolding so fast, with kidnap of foreign leaders, potential overthrow of the Iranian government. And this is what is wanted by the Western elites. The Anglo-Zionist Empire want to accelerate change, and they want to accelerate change towards their conflicts. And I think for those that, I mean, it's been an education for me the last couple of years, understanding what the accelerationism is all about. And you keep seeing this word popping up in with the thought leaders, whatever they call them, these pretend alternative media that David was mentioning get so much of the funding, and that's what they're up to. They're trying to accelerate crisis, and crisis upon crisis upon crisis, where, for example, as we had with COVID, you have a world crisis created by them. And the answer is, what is it? It's going to be this vaccine, which might actually help you. But actually, really, it's dragging you into an experiment on humanity, really, human experimentation. You are going to be a guinea pig. So this is exactly what I think we need to watch out for all over the place now, is massive change that they're trying to push onto humanity, which it takes you so long to figure out what's going on that there's already the next wave of change coming. That's the way the accelerationists love to operate.
Robbie, quickly.
Yeah, just the media framing is all important here. And, you know, the media is in the tank, right? And you see it, I try and deal with the media a lot. I'll get occasionally genuine media coverage of a small denomination issue, but when it comes to the big issues, the media always march in lockstep. And you had this extraordinary thing straight into the new year where Trump, people found it very hard to spin what Trump did. He attacked a sovereign nation to take their government hostage, right? And so there was a lot of concern being expressed across the board, etc. And then suddenly there's this switch, and suddenly the media is on safe ground because you've got this repeat of a human rights charade playing out in Iran, right? And the same media that might have even been prepared to put some slightly critical analysis of Trump over Venezuela because it was such a shocking incident, goes back to, situation normal now. You know, America's the liberator. America's the great savior. The people are oppressed. And let's just forget what we were prepared to say about Trump 24 hours ago to frame this. There's been a big effort, Mike, as you know, as we live here in Australia, to demonize Iran in the lead up to what's happened. David referred to the scam, the fake attacks that were all pinned on Iran. We kicked out the Iranian ambassador 2 weeks after I went and met him, by the way, with the former Australian ambassador to Iran. We had a meeting, and 2 weeks later, the poor guy was persona non grata. But then if the media bothered to be properly critical, they should be questioning why in the immediate hours after the Bondi massacre, when the media here was all scrambling, because no one can predict something like that's going to happen, but Benjamin Netanyahu was live on Australian TV within hours, as were a whole bunch of other, before any Australian politician of any authority was on television in Australia. Netanyahu was live in Australia, and he alluded in his first comments that the Bondi massacre was somehow connected to Iran. It had to be. What we know now, of course, is that the shooters were, ISIS affiliated, and therefore hate Iran. You cannot pin this on Iran in any way, shape or form, but that's what they tried to do, because they have been building up in Australia for us to support unquestioningly what America and whoever else is trying to do in Iran right now.
We're going to wrap this up because I know Tony has to go. We've gone way over. I just want to ask David and two questions. The first one is specific for David, and then the second one we'll keep for everybody. David, first question is, tell us about the, we've heard so much about the government executions that are going to start tomorrow. And secondly, how do you see the landscape in the next couple of weeks? Where do you see this moving to with Iran?
I mean, there will be executions of terrorists. That's right. I mean, that's what the law is there, and that will happen. I mean, what you find in Iran, people say, oh, the terribly repressive regime, blah, blah, blah. But actually, you know, the problem with Iran, if anything, is that it doesn't take its revolutionary responsibilities seriously enough. So I mentioned before the students invading the U.S. Embassy in 1980, and when I was there last year, lots of people said to me, well, they went a bit far. They shouldn't really have invaded the embassy. And of course, they hadn't done it under instructions from the leadership of the revolution. They'd done it because this was an outpost of imperialism. And it's still to this day a slogan they put on the wall at the time, down with imperialism, no imperialism in Iran, which, you know, statement with which I heartily agree. But the position in Iran is that there's far too much respect for Western ideas of fairness. If only we talk to the Americans, we can come to some sort of deal. No, this will not be happening. So if anything, there's too much liberalism in Iran and not enough adherence to the idea of the revolution and the necessity of the revolution in order to defend not just the Islamic Republic, not just the Palestinians, but I would say all of human civilization. And that's what's threatened by the Zionists and indeed by their hench people in Washington. So how will this develop? It looks like we're going to have an attack. It looks like the Iranians have imported new materials, including missiles and air defense, many of which were taken out by Zionist aircraft during the 12-day war. It looks like we're seeing reports about these jammers that they've been using. They confiscated 25,000 Starlink receivers, and they seem to have, according to the reports, I'm not sure if these are true, they seem to have jammed Starlink, which, of course, is what led to the whole thing collapsing. People in the West and left are saying, this is terrible. They can't possibly interfere with free communication. Where, of course, this is communication deliberately being used by a foreign power to undermine and subvert the government and the whole possibility of them existing separately and to make them into a Zionist puppet. So this is, of course, what we will see. We'll see an attack. And it's not clear that the Zionists can win this. And actually, if it drags on more than 12 days, the 12 days last time, the Zionists insisted that there had to be peace and the Americans put pressure on. In my view, the Iranian government should not have acceded to those demands from America. They should see America, as some people have said in Iran, as being dishonest, bad faith actor, and effectively in the pockets of the Zionists. So, you know, the only way we'll have peace in West Asia in general, across the whole of the region, is if we defeat Zionism. And I'm afraid that's the truth. And let's hope that happens soon.
Tony Gosling, I'll leave Robbie to last. Tony Gosling, tell me what your thoughts are. Where do you see the whole thing, the landscape? How do you see it in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we're heading for this kind of digital slavery here in the West, all these sort of digital IDs with less control over our own resources and money, forced slowly through the cost of living crisis into this kind of form of slavery where individuals are profiled and cut off from a living if they don't fit a certain direction. So it's, you know, this is one of the things I'd like. It's not just about Iran. David's done a good job there in just explaining what may happen over there. Quite right, there may well be an attack from the United States and from the Israelis and from the Anglo-Zionist Empire generally, not just propaganda, an actual real attack of some sort. So I think we need to understand the implications for our lives here too. There's been a lot of talk about this whole idea of a Pax Judaica, which is this network of influence. So the idea is the strings are being pulled by Zionists, maybe in Tel Aviv, maybe in London, maybe in Washington, but it's all working as a kind of coordinated effort not just to impose the empire's will on countries like Iran, anybody with independent thought in the Middle East particularly, but any part of the world, Malaysia, for example. We saw the mysterious disappearance of two of their airliners after the court case they held there, where they put Tony Blair, George Bush and Zippy Livni all on trial, who can no longer go to Malaysia. So any country really which has got an independent mind and its own morality is being subsumed into this giant Borg called the Anglo-Zionist Empire. And I think we just have to literally understand what's going on. We need to be more and more aware, as many young people actually are, about this. It's been called, the term has been coined, Pax Judaica. That's what I call it, Pax Zionica, because most of the Jews that I know want nothing to do with this imperialistic attitude. And they can see that both secular and religious Judaism has been hijacked. Look at the Neturi Carta, for example, in London and New York. This Orthodox Jewish organization is constantly out marching against the Zionist state of Israel. And so there is most definitely hope because, you know, David's saying they're not going to win militarily. I don't think they're going to win the hearts and minds of the Western world either.
Yeah, it's the future looks, I think, looks, actually, I've got no idea. I think it looks like the future. I have no idea. I think the arch enemy to peace is Donald Trump, and you just have to look at his actions from the last couple of last week or two. Robbie, what do you think? How do you think?
I haven't, and
just quickly, your views on the new bill that's about to be passed next week, which is part of the whole kit and caboodle, because Tony mentioned that we're about to enter a digital gulag, just about. And I don't know how we're going to get out of that, but the whole world is changing. And look at Trump, look at what's happening within our own borders, UK, the same thing. Look at what's happening internationally. It doesn't augur well, does it?
No, the bill that's going to be rammed through here on Monday and Tuesday next week in Parliament is appalling. It's retrospective. It explicitly says there's no obligation on the government for procedural fairness in applying it. It bans organisations and political parties. And like I said, it's retrospective. We actually started this process immediately after 9/11, Mike, when we used, Australia wasn't the only country. America had the Homeland Security Act and all that, but we use terrorist attacks to ram through laws that were previously unthinkable and not consistent with a democratic society. We started off with seven separate bills in 2002. Our organization fought them. Last time we counted, there was well over 100. So this bill next week is going to be a continuation of that. And some of it is what politicians, in a sense, get spooked into doing because they're headless chooks. They don't know what to do. Right, and they're easily manipulated at a time like this. But there will be a longer it's going to be very hard to stop this bill in next week because they're literally ramming it through. They gave 2 days for consultation. The Federal Police Commissioner, who testified to the parliamentary hearing when she was asked about the bill, and she's the one who will be applying the laws that it passes, she said she couldn't comment on the bill because she hadn't had time to read it. And that sort of exemplifies, you know, what's going on here in that sense. There will be a Royal Commission, a Federal Royal Commission, a Commonwealth Royal Commission, and that might be an opportunity. Often these things try and be rigged, but that might be an opportunity to intervene and establish some truth, because we already had this. We've had different kinds of laws passed in Australia since October 7, 2023 in the name of fighting terrorism and anti-Semitism at state level. And very quickly, the credibility of those laws has fallen apart as the news has emerged that things like the so-called spate of anti-Semitic attacks actually were faked, right? Sponsored by organized crime, etc. Just quickly, one final thought. I have to confess, 2016, November 2016, I wore a MAGA hat on the day Donald Trump was elected, only because I preferred him over Hillary Clinton. And a friend of mine who was an American had taken a bet with me. He had he ordered his dad to get ordered a MAGA hat from his dad, and I wore it on that day. Why did I prefer him over Hillary Clinton? Because everything he said in 2016 was the exact opposite of everything he has done now. Very prominent people in Australia, very prominent politician. You would know John Ruddick of the Libertarian Party, the biggest Trump booster in Australia when he was in the Liberal Party, announced a few days ago he is completely off the Trump bandwagon. Scott Ritter, the famous commentator who, you know, has, you know, he's not a total fan of Trump, but he's been generally on that side. He has said no more, right? This is total lies. This was always deliberate lies. If there was any hope that Trump might have been different, now we can see it absolutely isn't. I suspect there will be an attack. I suspect it won't work.
Fantastic. All in one breath. Absolutely brilliant. Gentlemen, I have to thank you very much. Professor David Miller, Robbie Barwick and Tony Gosling, thank you so much for your time. This is The Protagonist. I'm Mike Ryan on The World Today, and tomorrow we'll have yet another exciting discussion on events around the world, and I want to grab Robbie tomorrow or sometime in the next few days to talk about the bill, which is called the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism Bill 2026.
The Accelerationist Bill. Yeah, it's the Accelerationist Bill. You know, what we've done is we've created this Bondi Beach attack, and so we're going to make things worse. We're going to come up with a solution which actually destroys our democracy rather than makes anything better. This is absolutely perfect accelerationism you're getting over in Australia.
Yeah, it's a magnificent place. It's now becoming, because they shipped most of our great-great-great-grandparents from England or the UK over to Australia for nicking a spud or two, or some pumpkin or whatever. But then when they shipped us, it was a magnificent place, beautiful beaches, clean air, you know, fantastic. It is now a terrible place to live for many of us. And for those in Australia that don't understand what's going to happen.
Well, it's also a wonderful place to live, but the thing is, a lot of the psychology is to demoralise people. A lot of the press, the media, a lot of what we're seeing is the idea is to depress people and demoralise people. If you want to have a bit of fun in Australia, you're nearer to Shanghai than we are. Go over and check out this old school friend of mine, Nick Land, who's the father of accelerationism, who's dreamt up this whole thing as a real philosophy, and he's hiding away in some little apartment in Shanghai there. It'd be nice to see what Nick's got to say about the results of his accelerationist crusade.
Actually, we'll get Robbie to get hold of him for us. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. This is The Protagonist, and this has been The World Today.